From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, new electoral maps have Kansas legislators scrambling this weekend to find out what district they're running in. And we look at what drives Governor Sam Brown back.
We all knew during our high school years, we knew he was going to do something big and better than the rest of us. But
KCK residents wonder what will become of one of its downtown's most recognizable buildings.
That's a very difficult building to divide up into multiple floors or multiple spaces.
Plus, visit a garden that's being planted according to 1910 aesthetics.
At the time, Kansas City was a robust mix of the refined and the rowdy.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Three federal judges blew up the political landscape in Kansas on Thursday night when they unveiled new district maps. Sharp divisions between conservative and moderate Republicans had kept the legislature from agreeing on congressional and statehouse districts during the session. So the court came up with political districts that the state attorney general calls the most disruptive ever. KCUR's Frank Morris spoke with UpToDate's Steve Kraske on Friday about the upheaval.
Is it my imagination, Steve Kraske, or did the August 7th primaries in Kansas just get a whole lot more interesting?
No, that's absolutely right, Frank. You have literally almost a quarter or 20% of the state House now all having open seats, and 10% of the state Senate open seats, so new faces coming there as well. And you can bet there's just an absolute wild, mad scramble going on this weekend as the state parties try to find candidates to run in some of these open seats. There's already a lot of talk, Frank, about what happens if no one files for one of these seats, if there's no candidates running for the state house in a certain district. And a lot of folks out here in Kansas just don't know what will happen if that's the case.
You have to reside in the district.
That's right. You have to reside there at the time you file.
Right.
So you can guess that there'll be a lot of people renting apartments this weekend.
Oh, really?
Around the state if they want to, if they're interested in running for one of these open seats.
And you have 20%, a fifth of the Kansas House has two incumbents already in it. I mean, this is really a shakeup.
Exactly. And this is what happens when you have a nonpartisan group like courts and judges, you know, write these plans. When lawmakers do it, they work overtime to avoid these kinds of intra-party fights. But this year in Kansas, they just couldn't work it out for a whole host of reasons. But you can bet, you know, 10 years from now, when lawmakers go about this task again, they'll work a lot harder to get this thing resolved without having to go to the courts.
This is already going to be a really important primary season in Kansas because you're going to determine who controls the Kansas Senate. Is it going to be the conservatives or the moderate Republicans? And what happens now? Who are the winners in this?
Well, we don't know for sure yet, Frank. There's a whole lot of work being done as we speak, people trying to pencil this thing out and see who's advantaged by the shape of these districts. And that's going to take a little while. Some talk it might even take a couple weeks to really figure out which side of this equation came out ahead. No question, the legislature will still be dominated by Republicans. The only question really is, will the conservatives take control of the state Senate next January, or will it continue to be a moderate bastion? And we simply don't know the answer to that yet, Frank.
And that is a big question. For Kansas policy, that is a huge question.
It's an enormous question because, as this year showed, the state Senate under moderate control proved to be really the last sort of speed bump in front of Sam Brownback, who is trying to pass a very aggressive agenda, a very conservative agenda. And it was the state Senate that gave him fits almost from the start. He didn't have too much trouble in the state House. So really, it's the state Senate where the rubber is hitting the road in Kansas politics these days. And how this shakes out, will moderates continue to control it? Will conservatives take over? That really is the tale of the tape in Kansas right now.
Is this actually a good way to draw a map?
Yeah, it is. I think so. And I've written columns suggesting as much in the newspaper, Frank. It makes a whole lot of sense to me because the districts are being drawn based on non-political considerations. You know, it's really sort of the way it should be done. The fact that you have incumbents running against each other, that's probably a healthy thing. To me, that's the way they should be drawn. Communities of interest should be a factor here, not preserving the long-term political safety of incumbents year after year after year.
Steve Kraske, thanks very much for joining us.
You bet, Frank. Glad to do it.
Steve Kraske is the political correspondent for the Kansas City Star and host of Up to Date here on KCUR. He spoke to Frank Morris. Now, redistricting was just one of the issues that made this past legislative session one of the most turbulent in recent memory. At the heart of the conflict was the very conservative agenda Governor Sam Brownback put forward for his first term. He signed a host of meaty bills, including a reform of the state's Medicaid and pension laws, and also one of the most draconian tax cuts in Kansas history. The governor says his free market philosophy is driven by a devout faith. Many supporters and critics alike say he's equally, or more, driven by political ambition. Laura Ziegler takes a closer look at the puzzling Kansas governor.
Governor Brownback's hometown of Parker, Kansas, population 350, is a hollowed-out bedroom community like many of those you see as you drive across western Kansas. The governor's known here as Sam, and when he graduated from Prairie View High, people had a hunch he wouldn't go back to the farm like most grads do. At the corner of County Road 107 and Main Street, across from an old boarded-up building, is the new Parker Library. Sam came back for the opening, and he regularly donates books. I asked the librarian, Sherry Dunlop, who grew up with Sam, if it was strange to hear people calling him governor.
No. We all knew during our high school years, we knew he was going to do something big and better than the rest of us. But
he looks wholesome, doesn't he?
Senior Sam Brownback's all over the pages of the 1974 Buffalo Expression, the school's yearbook. He has the same squarish head, the bushy brown hair, as he does today, as well as that confident smile of a man with plans. He was an officer with the student council, court-warming king, that's the homecoming king on a basketball court, a state officer with the Future Farmers of America. The principal is Tim Weiss. He's relatively new, but he knows Brownback's legacy.
Sam was always a leader among his classmates, and, you know, he worked very hard to do well in school.
Sam's ambition paid off in spades. He got a degree in agricultural economics from K-State, a law degree from KU, where he was class president. In 1986, he became the state's Secretary of Agriculture at 30, a White House fellow a few years later, and he was a U.S. congressman in less than 10 years. After one term in the House, he won Bob Dole's Senate seat when Dole ran for president, even though party officials had picked someone else. The congressman from Kansas quickly distinguished himself among a new class of firebrand freshmen in 1974. They were conservatives, and they called themselves New Federalists. They crusaded for the government-shrinking contract with America. Brownback was one of just two congressmen who thought that contract was too liberal and refused to sign it at first. It was a heady time for Brownback. He was the darling of the national press and at the top of his political game when he got the devastating news he had melanoma. The tumor was successfully removed, but Brownback later wrote in a confessional memoir, the surgery on his soul was a lot harder. It was a spiritual epiphany for the already devout Methodist. One night I got down on my knees and said, "Okay, Lord, that's it," he wrote in his memoir. "I give up. This life is yours." He embraced evangelical Christianity and speaks often and publicly about his faith-driven politics.
I think we as a society are trying to find our way back into talking about how faith does inform things rather than just dismissing it or saying, well, we really can't go there, or separation of church and state says we can't even talk about it. No, I mean, we're a faith-oriented country.
This is a tamer version of a political theology Brownback cultivated when he went to Washington in 1994. That year, he joined a group home called C Street, sponsored by the Fellowship, which is also known as the Family. It's a 75-year-old fundamentalist Christian political ministry. C Street members have included such power brokers as South Carolina's Strom Thurmond, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, and Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma. Coburn once advocated the death penalty for abortion providers and lobbied with Brownback to allow churches to campaign for political candidates. Brownback also chaired a coalition of Christian organizations known as the Value Action Team that debated the Christian underpinnings of individual votes. He affiliated with evangelist Lou Engel, who brought tens of thousands together for revivals known as The Call. Brownback lived with Engel for a time in D.C. and has appeared several times at The Call's rallies.
Welcome The Call!
In 2002, Brownback was baptized into the Catholic Church by a priest with Opus Dei. Opus Dei means literally the work of God. It's a small but controversial Catholic institution. Rick Santorum was his sponsor. Brownback regularly attends Catholic Mass, as well as a Bible church in Topeka, and he describes himself as a seeker, interested in all things spiritual. His searching has spilled over to bipartisan action on a number of humanitarian causes, genocide in Darfur, human rights in North Korea, and human sex trafficking. At the same time, he's been outspoken about the threat of fundamentalist Islam since 9/11. He recently signed legislation in Kansas, similar to laws in some 20 states, that bans the use of foreign laws. Critics see it as an attack on Sharia or traditional Islamic law. It was 2010 when Sam Brownback came back as governor of Kansas and immediately got to work shrinking state government. He closed state offices, slashed funding for education and social services, and he eliminated the State Commission on the Arts, which ultimately was reorganized under the Department of Commerce.
It's a movie theater. You know, I got to hit the style points.
This spring, the governor stood before reporters and awkwardly made fun of his hip dark glasses at the groundbreaking of AMC's new corporate headquarters in Leawood. He told the future workers, many of them transferring from Los Angeles, that he put his faith in the people of Kansas, and he wanted Kansas to be a model of good government.
We wanted to be able to show the whole country that you can run quality businesses like this right in the heartland, and you can do it well, and you can do it with great people. And we want to show that throughout the country. We want to show it around the world.
At the end of this latest session, Brownback signed the largest tax cut in state history. Legislative analysts say it will rack up $2.5 billion in red ink. Critics in and out of the legislature were furious. They said the governor approved exemptions on some partnerships and corporations that will financially benefit his largest contributors, like the billionaire Koch brothers in Wichita. Former Republican state senator Wint Winters, now a CEO of a large Kansas bank, says the bill is unconscionable.
I've got a concern about it. I'm a cradle Catholic. My concern is that the budget bill, the tax bill, is going to gut significantly social services and, as a practical matter, hurt poor people and deteriorate the quality of life and respect for life.
But Brownback pushed his bold agenda with missionary zeal and some of the most aggressive, old-fashioned politicking Topeka has seen in years. After the session ended, the governor's Facebook page had this message. Our state has gone through an incredible transition in just 2 years, from a projected $500 million deficit to putting nearly $500 million in the bank. That swing can only occur when we commit ourselves to shrinking the footprint of state government and pursuing policies that grow the economy.
The impact of Sam's faith is in the way he treats people.
Republican State Senator Arlen Siegfried believes it was a triumphant session for the governor. He believes Sam Brownback is unique in the way he marries his political career with good old-fashioned Midwestern values.
I really appreciate his humility. He is just that kind of man. All politicians, including me, have ambitions. How much farther those ambitions go, I have no idea.
Repeated requests to sit down with the governor for this story, even get an email response to specific questions, were unsuccessful. So for now, that balance between Sam Brownback's faith and his political ambition remains between him and his advisors and his God. Laura Ziegler, KCUR News.
Coming up, KCK residents sound off about the departure of the EPA from downtown. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We thought we'd follow up today on a couple of legislative stories we've done on KC Currents recently. About a month ago, we reported on a bill in the Missouri legislature that would allow Kansas City to create a land bank. These land banks would give the city the power to acquire unwanted properties and vacant homes to sell or demolish them. David Park is the director of Kansas City's Department of Neighborhood and Community Services. He told me in April about the dangers of having vacant homes in the community.
I mean, there's been studies that have shown like a vacant foreclosed home will lower the property values of adjoining properties by almost 10%. So that's, you know, 10% lower value of the house next door across the street from it.
Park said that a land bank would allow the city to work with local investors who are interested in turning the property into something valuable for the community.
You know, if we can get at those auctions or from the banks, get control of those properties, then we can work with our local investors who do have an interest in actually taking the property, renovating it, you know, selling it or renting it. There's a lot of local investors, you know what we'd call the good investors, that we can work with to get these properties out of their blighted condition and into a condition that's an asset for the community.
So a few weeks ago, the Missouri General Assembly passed the land bank bill. It's now awaiting Governor Jay Nixon's signature.
In other legislative news, back in February, we reported that a movement to outlaw Sharia, or Islamic law, has been gaining momentum in the region. Alex Smith spoke to Riaz Larif of the Islamic Circle of North America about this legislation.
Sharia includes believing in Prophet Muhammad, Prophet Jesus, Prophet Moses. Sharia includes doing a worship, like prayer and fasting. So if we were to say that I'm not following Sharia, we are essentially saying that we are not Muslims.
A Sharia-related bill ended up failing in the Missouri legislature, but a similar one passed in Kansas. A few weeks ago, Governor Sam Brownback signed it into law. It prohibits state courts and agencies from considering Islamic or other non-U.S. laws when making court decisions. Critics say the law has the potential to nullify Islamic wills or contracts. Supporters of the bill point to cases such as divorce hearings where men under Sharia law have more options than women. They also point out that Muslims are still allowed to practice Sharia, but they are not protected by Sharia law in courts.
This fall, voters in Missouri will face a number of decisions, picking state and congressional representatives and, of course, the President of the United States. But like 2 years ago, on the ballot will also be a measure that has to do with the federal health law. And as KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, the measure follows months of political tension over a key component.
The federal health law envisions that by 2014, each state will have an online marketplace where individuals and small businesses can buy health insurance plans that meet certain criteria and are more easily comparable. These marketplaces are also known as health exchanges, and they can be run by either the state or the federal government. As it stands, an exchange does not exist in Missouri. Yet. And if it's up to Missouri's House Majority Leader, Tim Jones, it never will.
We know that the citizens of the state of Missouri do not want the federal health care law, the Obamacare law, or anything related to it.
Jones, a Republican, spoke on the final day of session last month in favor of Senate Bill 464. The bill prohibits the creation and operation of a health exchange in Missouri unless the legislature or voters give it the okay, and it prohibits the governor from creating one through executive order. The bill passed during those final hours of session and will now be up for a popular vote in November. Jones said it's a chance for Missourians to affirm their stance on the federal health law, like in 2010.
71% of Missourians voted less than 2 years ago to prohibit anything related to this.
The issue then was the federal mandate for buying insurance or paying a fine. Opposition to that is what voters wrote into the state constitution when passing Proposition C. Senator Rob Schaff, a Republican from St. Joseph who sponsored this latest ballot measure, says a health exchange, not the entire law, is his main issue.
A health insurance exchange is a major policy decision, and it should require the input of the legislature. I mean, that's my concern for filing this bill.
Schaff says Governor Nixon, a Democrat, previously went around the legislature's back in trying to set up an exchange. His administration, the Department of Insurance, applied for and received a federal grant last year to start setting up the technical infrastructure for an exchange, including updating the state's old Medicaid computer system. The administration channeled the funds to a quasi-government body that wasn't subject to legislative oversight.
I was inflamed and decided to offer up this bill.
The group faced additional pressure from Schaff and other lawmakers and has since suspended any health exchange activity and turned the grant money over to the legislature to appropriate. They haven't done that and are waiting to see how the Supreme Court rules on the entire law, so most of that money is still sitting unused with the federal government. Schaff says he wants to further ensure nothing happens without the legislature or voters being on board. That's why included in this ballot measure is the ability for people to sue any state agency or worker involved in any exchange activity. Some people worry about this.
I have a concern that bill hanging out there will have a chilling effect.
Andrea Ruth is director of the consumer group, the Missouri Health Advocacy Alliance. Ruth says the ballot measure itself, even before it's voted on, could cause Missouri to fall behind on preparing for an exchange in 2014. State workers might not do anything for fear of being sued, even though a lot has to happen for the exchange to be ready.
It can really work well for families if we do it right. But doing it right takes some work and planning and time and, you know, people weighing in on how enrollment's going to work and how, you know, our plan choices are going to be presented to us on this internet kind of platform. And if we're waiting till the last minute to do it, there's a potential that it may not be that workable for people.
If the measure does pass in November, it could be declared unconstitutional. But even so, Ken Warren, a political scientist at St. Louis University, says having it on the November ballot is a gain for Republicans.
They used opposition to Obamacare to win elections in 2010, and they will try to do the same in 2012, particularly to help defeat Obama by bringing out a lot of Republicans getting into the polls to vote not only against this measure, but while they're there to vote against Obama.
Meanwhile, getting back to the exchanges themselves, their fate and that of the entire health law rests on what the Supreme Court does. Answers on that will be coming very soon. A decision is expected by the end of this month. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
The Environmental Protection Agency's regional headquarters offices in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, will officially be moving to a new location this fall. Their new home, the former Applebee's headquarters in Lenexa, Kansas. This news came as quite a shock to the unified government of Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas. The giant glass-arched building with an atrium inside was custom-built for the EPA and its nearly 600 employees only 12 years ago. A lawsuit against the federal government was dismissed last week, making the move concrete and leaving the building's owners, Urban America, in search of new tenants. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan spoke with downtown KCK residents and employees to see how they feel about losing the EPA as a neighbor.
They built that building. We need it here in Kansas City, Kansas. Why take this out to Johnson County? Everything they want to move out there. I don't think it's right.
I was mad because we don't have enough businesses that are doing well down here, and that was something that was, I think, promoting businesses down here, and it's a waste of a good building.
Really, why are they moving? Is it really necessary for them to move? And is it saving them that much money to move? And I definitely would like to see them stay or somebody else to be here.
I'm in construction, so I pretty much, you know, work in Kansas and Missouri, and, you know, new buildings that go up all the time. So, you know, moves for me is good. It's more work, so it's a plus.
You just can't tell the government what to do. They're going to move. We say we'll stay, but that's about all I can tell you. I mean, we'd like to bring some kind of business, office business in there, but if not, it's going to be an empty shell, like all around here, around this area here. We got a lot of empty shells in here.
Actually, I would say good riddance. You know, maybe they can find somebody else to move in that building, because if they really don't want to be here, you know, do we really want them here? My name is Mark Ming. I work at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library. I work in the security department. you know, if they want to go, you know, how can you really stop them?
I have a lot of customers that come here daily, and I do a lot of catering for EPA. Therefore, my business will be hurt, definitely. My name is Ellen Hume. I've been here for over 30 years, and the name of the business is J. Wiley Bakery Bistro.
Do you have a plan for when that move's going to happen?
No, I just have to wait and see what comes in there. Hopefully, it'll be something that will benefit all the small businesses in the area.
Add a smoked wings to that order.
Well, I found out about it being announced that the EPA was leaving the Wyandotte County area, and being an entrepreneur with Big Grill and More, being that that particular building was built specifically for the EPA, being in the Wyandotte County area, I hated to see it leave the area. And with the EPA being an organization that's supposed to be with the urban development, I thought it would be in the urban core instead of the suburbs.
My name is John Biscannon. I'm an attorney. I've been an attorney for many years. Obviously, we were quite pleased some years ago when the EPA decided to not only put their office facility here, but also their testing facility just a couple blocks down the street. That seemed to make a lot of sense to a lot of people, including myself. And, of course, at the time that it was built to the most high, to the highest existing standards then required of a federal building. It's a beautiful building. It's a nice addition to the city, of course. And, of course, having the jobs here makes it a more viable and livable place, too. So here it was being moved to Lenexa to a cornfield seemed a little strange to us, given the fact that it's going to be far removed now from the testing facility.
You just heard the voices of Mrs. Jones, Bonnie Castro, Glenn Hawking, Dustin Maupin, Raymond Ibarra, Mark Ming, Ellen Hume, Leela Dantzler, and John Biscannon. Now, there were a lot of people that I talked to who were oblivious to the move and the EPA in general, but most of the people I talked to seem, well, miffed. And when I asked them what they thought might take the EPA's place, they had no idea. So I talked to someone who's working on figuring that out.
Hi, my name is Greg Kendall. I'm the president of Wyandotte Economic Development Council. The natural knee-jerk reaction is to be disappointed. You never want to lose any kind of employees or a large customer, client, employer from your community. So that's always difficult to take. You want to keep everybody, you want to grow them, and hope that they're a part of the community for long periods of time. In this case, it just wasn't possible to make that work, and so we have to move forward.
Where are you in the process of finding new tenants right now?
We're in the early process of finding new tenants. We were waiting to see how the lawsuit would turn out with the unified government, and now that the unified government has dropped its lawsuit against the EPA, we can now begin the active process of responding to potential prospects. The CBRE, C.B. Richard Ellis, is the brokerage, that company that we'll be working with to identify clients and potential customers as well. So we will coordinate with them, as well as the hope of bringing additional professional services types of employees back to the downtown core.
How quickly are you hoping to turn around with new occupancy?
It's hard to say how quickly we can fill it. By the time you get inquiry from a potential applicant or employer to be inside the building to putting together a proposal, meeting their time frames. At the minimum, I would say it would take 6 months. It could be longer before we get a full new tenant back in that facility. It's not unusual for a 200,000 square foot facility of this size to take some time to fill, because it is a very unique tenant that we want to have in that location. It's a very iconic building, a very prime location within the community and in the region. And frankly, there aren't that many Class A office buildings available in the metropolitan area that are for lease.
Do you have an ideal tenant, and has the situation with EPA kind of changed the type of tenant that you're looking for in the future?
The ideal tenant is going to be a single entity that has upwards of 500 plus employees, ideally, professional services. So those that are going to be hopefully making good wages. But ideally, it's going to be a single tenant, because that's a very difficult building to divide up into multiple floors or multiple spaces, just the way in which it was constructed and built for the EPA. Could be banking, could be insurance, could be a technology company that has back office. It could be anything in that gamut. Urban America, I would imagine, is mostly interested in finding someone who wants an office environment to lease the entire building.
I spoke with a lot of people in the community who have hopes that the new occupants will boost the local economy or employ Kansas City, Kansas residents. Is that a concern for you? And if so, how do you plan to achieve that?
Well, the idea, anytime we're doing an economic development project and we're trying to bring new employees and new prospective clients into the area, is that they're going to be engaged employees, engaged companies in the community, that they will contribute to the local sales tax, that they'll move into the community or hire from within the community and be part of the community. I would not necessarily say that the EPA, in that sense, met that kind of criteria. I wouldn't necessarily say that they were, you know, hugely committed to into the community. I think whomever we bring in to fill that space, I'd like to see them be more fully engaged into the community itself.
Greg Kendall, I want to thank you so much for being on KC Currents.
Thank you very much.
Greg Kendall is the president of the Wyandotte Economic Development Council. For KC Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. The Kansas City Museum is in its third phase of a major restoration of Corinthian Hall. That's its home in the Old Northeast, a mansion built in 1910 for lumber magnate R.A. Long. And the renovation doesn't stop just at the bricks and mortar. A recent project aims to recreate the Georgian garden that surrounded Corinthian Hall. Three full-time caretakers tended the original garden and grounds. Just about all that's left of them are the sunken spaces. The Kansas City Museum enlisted the help of the Westport Garden Club to discover the plants and methods they would need to make the garden historically accurate. Susan went to check out the progress.
It's a perfect day to stroll through the gardens of Corinthian Hall. A lush green carpet of grass anchors the sprawling grounds. Stately oaks and maples brush against a cloudless blue sky, and a rotating sprinkler waters patches of new sod and recently planted flowers. I meet Museum Director Christopher Leach here and ask him about turn-of-the-century garden trends.
It was advocated by garden designers at the turn of the century to combine radically different colors, radically different leaf sizes, flower shapes and colors and textures in order to achieve the most robust and dynamic combination of visual experiences that you could provide for your garden visitor. And I think we've accomplished that here at Corinthian Hall. The gardens that were popular at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century were very rich and elaborate and included architectural features and small sculptures as well as what were called at the time carpet gardens because they were so densely and elaborately planted that they represented hand-woven oriental carpets. There were a number of such flower beds. We call them parterre gardens today, or on-the-earth gardens, on the site, including at the north gate and at the south facade, which is the major presentation of our historic site to the street.
Now, does the style of gardening that was used then, which I figured it was kind of an English style, what did it tell you about the people who lived then?
It's a very interesting way to get to know the Long family from the style of gardens. At the time, Kansas City was a robust mix of the refined and the rowdy, and the Long family were certainly on the refined side of life. Their wonderful mansion here, Corinthian Hall, exemplifies the Beaux-Arts architectural style, and the grounds certainly reflect the grandeur of the building that they surround. The beds are well-maintained and well-groomed and carefully cultivated, but they also show a richness and a density and a lushness, and that balance between the naturalistic and the evidence of the man-made was an historic characteristic that exemplified much of what was going on in wealthy America at the time. We have to remember that the Long's peers nationally were the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, and the Rockefellers and the Pullmans. So he had good examples of the kind of rich historic environment he was attempting to create in referring to the cottages, as they're known in Newport, Rhode Island, and other large mansions that he visited around the country.
So where are we headed first?
We're headed to the south facade of Corinthian Hall, where we will see installed two elliptical beds that would be the first thing a visitor would see as they're driving along Gladstone Boulevard, approaching the museum from the south. These beds complement some surviving plantings at the south facade, some of which include irises from Longview Farm, which the Long family built and operated until 1971 upon the death of Lula Long Combs. What we see here are two elliptical beds that are 20 feet long and approximately 7.5 feet wide, and they are placed symmetrically on either side of the front walk leading to the front door of Corinthian Hall. We have a wonderful arrangement of canna lilies and castor bean, which were very commonly used in older gardens and will be familiar to any gardener today. Surrounding them in concentric circles, if you think of a badge or a medallion or an oval carpet, since we're talking about carpet beds, are a variety of salvia or sage, which blooms bright purple, pentas, which is a low-growing plant with a bright red flower, and what we have around the edge giving a contrasting border is dusty miller. It appears to be white or very, very light green from a distance, and it helps the bed stand out in contrast. It's like a bright white outline around the oval, lifting it up from the dark green lawn that surrounds it. We placed the castor beans here in the beds on the front because children and other visitors don't have direct access to these beds without supervision. That's important because the castor fruit is deadly poisonous. And while they're very beautiful and we wanted to benefit from the historic reference of having this plant in our garden, we didn't want any of our visitors having that kind of unpleasant experience while they're here at the museum.
So the castor bean has a little spiky red fruit, it looks like.
It looks like a little pincushion or a sea urchin, and there are a number of them on a bright red stem, and the leaves are pointed and shaped sort of like a palm leaf, and they're bright red and purple, and these plants will grow to be between 6 and 8 feet tall.
I see already the butterflies seem to enjoy the garden.
We have quite a number of butterflies who've been visiting us. The real fans of the fresh planting are the robin redbreasts who nest around the site. Whenever we're watering, they come hunting, and they spend a lot of time marching around in between the flowers. We hope they're pulling some weeds while they're in there.
So what was the biggest challenge of this project?
I think that behind the scenes for any garden design and installation project is a lot of research, not just on design and the kinds of plants you want to use. In this instance, we needed to maintain historic accuracy, so there was an added level of research necessary there. And then the examination of the site and where we were going to install, the condition of the soil there, how that needed to be treated and brought up to snuff to sustain intense dense planting of annuals and some perennials, and then locating examples of the plants that were used historically. Some were very easy to find, such as coleus and petunia and marguerite daisies, because those are very commonly used in gardens today. But there were a couple of others, like the banana trees in the center of our quatrefoil beds on the north side of the estate, that were a little difficult to locate. Finally, we located actually a former staff member of the museum who has, of all things, Japanese mountain banana trees in their garden. And they donated some examples of those for us to include in the quatrefoil beds. Those kinds of exotic plant samples were very common in Gilded Age or Beaux-Arts gardens because they were difficult to come by and they demonstrated the worldliness and the breadth of vision of those who were planting the gardens. So we knew we had to have some tropical examples, and we were very lucky to get those little banana trees for our quatrefoil beds.
Christopher Leach is the director of the Kansas City Museum at Corinthian Hall to see photos of the historic garden in progress and what it looked like in 1910. Go to the KC Currents page of our website.
After the break, the grand reopening of the Black Archives of Mid-America. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, longtime Leawood State Senator John Vrattle announced that he won't run again. Testimony began in the latest school funding lawsuit, and Kansas finally got a set of redistricting maps by court order. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach called the redistricting maps produced by three federal judges the most disruptive ever. 3 days before filing deadline, Kansas politicos faced four state Senate districts with multiple incumbents, more than 20 in the House, and for every district with multiples, there's another that now has nobody running. Amid it all, GOP State Senator John Vrattle of Leawood announced his retirement. Vrattle's comments on the maps the court produced?
If the House had it to do all over again today after the court-drawn maps, my guess is that their attitude would be greatly different, and they would say, why don't we just let the Senate have whatever map the Senate wants and the House have whatever map the House wants, just like we used to do in the good old times.
In another courtroom, the battle over Kansas education funding continued. Several dozen districts are suing the state over millions of dollars in funding that was not budgeted. Alan Roop represents the school districts.
The legislature appropriated but did not send to the schools for 2009, 10, and 10, 11, amounting to about $23 million.
Arguing for the state is Attorney General Derek Schmidt.
The legislature has made balanced judgments about a variety of competing interests of the state, and our role will be to defend the difficult balances the legislature struck.
Any decision will likely be appealed to the Kansas Supreme Court. Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe said there will be no criminal charges against former Kansas Bioscience Authority CEO Tom Thornton. Howe says there was mismanagement, impropriety, and violation of KBA policies, but
mismanagement or failure to follow policies and procedures were done openly and with the approval of the KBA management and the board of directors.
Howe's investigation of the KBA lasted a year. Kansas City Police Chief Daryl Forte reported to a city council committee after reports in the Kansas City Star that 6 out of 10 murder cases were dropped because victims' families wouldn't testify. Forte said he wants to try several things, including adding email and text messages to the persuasion toolkit and simply more contact with the bereaved.
We drive up and down many streets every day. And if you have some people on your list or a person on your list, stop by and ask if they want to prosecute now.
Another committee advanced a proposal to give the city manager the authority to issue condemnation notices on properties whose owners have not reached buyout agreements so the city can have their land for the new East Patrol Police Campus. Assistant City Manager Pat Klein emphasized the fairness of the offers the city is making.
We didn't want to put anybody where they felt like it at the end of this. They're in a worse shape than they were coming into it.
Also in council chambers, Deputy Police Chief Cheryl Rose reported on a new study that suggests red light cameras are reducing accidents. Wrapping up the week, a circuit judge upheld the Cass County Board of Commissioners' right to keep a zoo's sales tax off the ballot there, despite the number of petitions collected. And opponents of a bare-breasted sculpture at the Overland Park Arboretum launched a petition drive to call a grand jury to rule on whether it's obscene. This is KCUR.
The Black Archives of Mid-America opens in its new home in the 18th and Vine District next weekend. This is good news for the beleaguered organization. Back in the 1970s, Horace Peterson began collecting artifacts, documents, and photographs that tell the story of the region's African-American community. The collection fell on hard times after Peterson died unexpectedly in 1992. But with help from the city and the public library, the Black Archives will now have both exhibit and archive space. Topeka-born Doretha Williams took over as executive director at the end of last year. Susan talked to her back in January about her plans for programming at the Black Archives.
My biggest goal is to bring the community back to the Black Archives and have the archives open for the community. Everywhere I go, someone talks about the Black Archives, their experiences. They worked with Horace Peterson, or they worked on this collection, or young people who tell me, oh, when I was younger, I used to play in Aunt Lucy's Cabin. So there are people who want the archive to open and to provide that service, to provide that site of intellectual inquiry, of research, and public programming. So my biggest goal is to bring the community back and have this place open for patrons and those who want to do research, those who want to submit their collections or what have you. So that is the biggest goal right now.
So I'm curious, you're someone who's had a scholarly interest in a lot of these topical areas. Do you find yourself, even now as you're here, going through some of the stuff with great interest?
Yes, I do. And that causes a problem sometimes because I'm, you know, needing to be working here. But yeah, I get in the archives sometimes and get to digging through things and things that are really interesting. Plus, learning more about the Kansas City area has been, I guess, a real thrill for me right now.
These various collections, what story do they begin to tell? What themes start to emerge about the Kansas City community?
You have a narrative of African Americans, smaller in population, you know, related to other areas of the country, but a collection of African Americans searching for that full citizenship in what we call, you know, the West or the Central Plains. So you have that idea of developing communities, ingenuity, helping to grow and stabilize the Black community in this region.
What's currently here at Black Archives of Mid-America if people were to come down to see when it opens?
We have a collection of older African-American literature that may or may not be in circulation anymore. And then we also have some items from a collection of the Buffalo Soldiers. When it opens in June, we'll have the permanent exhibit, and that's titled My Eyes Are No Longer Blind, which is a history in an exhibit of African Americans in Kansas City. Right now, the collection contains a lot of valuable pieces, history of Freedom Inc. We also have a lot of information and material on the call. We have collections of photographs from different people in the community starting back, you know, in the early 20th century.
All of these materials were in danger just a few years ago. The caretakers of the collection hadn't paid property taxes for several years, and Jackson County had sued. Then, failure to submit audits prompted the city council to stop giving the organization its subsidy. In yet another blow, the Missouri Secretary of State's office dissolved the archives as a nonprofit because it wasn't filing annual reports. Many were concerned that the material, most of which is irreplaceable, was threatened by mold and mildew. But now, Doretha Williams says those concerns are behind them.
The collection is secure right now. It was due to the efforts of individuals really involved with the archive, Barbara Peterson, who is the widow of Horace Peterson, the founder, Sharon Sanders Brooks, individuals at the library, and individuals in the community came together and said, you know, we have to secure this collection. You know, it's priceless. And so that was when Governor Jay Nixon was the Attorney General, and he also helped to bring the community together to have a discussion of what are we going to do. And that's when it was decided to get the collection secure and to find a facility to house it in.
On the flip side of that, though, is there any concern about, with the library stepping in, that the African-American community loses control over an important asset?
I would say to that all relationships shift and move. And I don't believe it's the intention of the public library to take over or to have a power trip about the situation here. And, you know, we're in an economy that, you know, folks can't really just take over other people's stuff anyway these days. So I don't think that's an issue at all. But the relationship will move and fluctuate as the Black Archives continues to develop a permanent staff, its own situation when it comes to programming and financing. So it'll shift and move. I don't think that should be a concern.
By the way, the Black Archives used to sponsor Juneteenth. Is that a tradition that will begin again, do you think, or is that on the back burner for right now?
That is actually not on the back burner. The opening, June 16th, will actually coincide with a Juneteenth celebration. And I've heard of the ones in the past. It may not be the grandiose ones, but we're going to get there eventually. But no, the Black Archives will definitely be working with others in the community, because there are other organizations who will be doing work on Juneteenth. And we want to collaborate with the entire district and the entire city to bring that back to its heyday.
Doretha Williams is executive director of the Black Archives. We spoke back in January. The Archives kicks off a series of grand opening events over the next 2 weeks with a ribbon cutting at the new space on Saturday at noon. Find a link to more information about the grand opening on our website at kcur.org. Well, thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith and help from Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski. Our theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.